in Cambridge with Anthony Lewis.
And that's in the two papers in case anyone actually finds it interesting. There's going to be like roughly three sort of sections to the talk. I'm going to basically give an introduction to magnetic fields in the universe. I'm going to talk briefly about the problem of the origins of the fields. And then I'm going to move into what I've actually done with this. So I'll just start with a sort of brief introduction. Basically, the reason you might be interested in magnetic fields in the universe and primordial magnetic fields is that is any way you look, if you can make a measurement of them, you tend to see them. So if you look in a galaxy, you measure it by some method, you see magnetic fields, same with clusters, and generally what you observe, the fields are at about one microgauss level. So that's, for reference, the magnetic field on the Earth is about gauss. Sorry about the CGS units for anyone there. So the way you look for these fields is by the sort of three methods. One, you can look for synchrotron emission. So in a magnetic medium, if you've got high energy electrons, they wind around the magnetic fields, and if they spiral, they emit radiation, and that's synchrotron, and it's polarized. And so you can actually infer the direction of the magnetic field from synchrotron. Another method is Faraday rotations. As you know, light propagates through a medium like a plasma with a magnetic field in. It causes there to be two different refractive indices, one for left polarized light and one for light, right polarized light. And that causes a rotation of the it causes a rotation of the polarization of the light, and that's frequency dependent, so you can tell that method. The other thing is more difficult. You can do Zeeman splitting measurements where the energy of atomic transitions is actually split by the magnetic field, so otherwise they'd be degenerate with no magnetic field. So just shifting to what these kind of fields look like
in a galaxy.
This is M51, and this is mapped, well, the background stuff you can see is the optical image, but these contours represent the radius. So this is synchrotron emission in a galaxy. And you can see the contours basically tell you where the magnetic field is strong. If you can see, what you can see at the back, these vectors might tell you the direction of the magnetic field. So you can see that, you know, basically it appears anywhere you see light, and also that the field tends to be oriented along, you know, the spiral arms of the galaxy. So this means it's got quite a large correlation. So it's correlated on scales roughly comparable to the galaxy itself, at least at what you can resolve. So hundreds of galaxies have had magnetic fields detected in them. They're all in about the 1 to 10 microgauss level. You observe them in all types of galaxies, spiral galaxies, little galaxies, and dwarf irregular galaxies have all had magnetic fields observed. As I said, the spirals have coherence on very large scales comparable to size, and the ellipticals have much smaller coherence. But one of the most important measurements you have is that if you look at galaxies at high redshift, so where it's been possible to do the measurements, you can find magnetic fields of comparable strength at redshifts of this 0.7 is this Wolf result, and I think this the Bernay result is much higher, I think. So this is this Wolf one was measured with Zeeman splitting, and this one was measured with Faraday rotation in the intervening medium. And this result tends to be, well, if it's all correct, it may have quite important implications, which I'll come back to.
With between strength of magnetic field and mass of the galaxy or morphology?
With morphology, I think there's some. So I think the galaxies and ellipticals tend to be weaker. The fields and ellipticals tend to be slightly weaker. I'm not aware of any correlation with mass, but that's probably my ignorance rather than anything else. Okay, so if we shift up the scale, This is the coma cluster, I think, when it's mapped in its synchrotron emission. And you can see that all these dark blobs are associated with galaxies, but this diffuse stuff is just associated with this medium itself. And so you can see that, you know, there's a magnetic field associated, you know, well, in the intercrustal medium.
Now, this field, if you try and work what strength it is, depending on a few things, the field strengths tend to be at about 0.1 to 3 micrograph level, so they're less strong, but they are still of a reasonable kind of strength. If you go to even larger scales, you can see radio emission between clusters of reasonable separation in some cases. And this suggests there might be fields on the kind of supercluster sort of scale of weak still but of comparable strength. And there's a very recent observation, I guess. It's slightly complex, uses an effect of if you have a TV blazar source, so it's sending out very high things, basically interactions with photons to produce pair, you have pair production, and then these pairs are deflected by magnetic fields, and then before they annihilate, and this kind of spreads out lower energy emission. And you might, if there was no magnetic field, you would expect to see gamma rays associated with this. In fact, they don't suggest that there's actually a minimum magnetic field in the intergalactic medium of 10 to the minus 16 Gex. So the implications of this result are still being debated in some circumstances, but it's clearly going to be quite important if it's valid. So what I'm going to shift to now is just to talk about the origins of this field, what might they be, talk about some of the problems with that, and some of the implications these observations have on that. So, astrophysically, it's actually quite difficult to produce a magnetic field. If you take a galaxy which is already formed, you would actually need to, if you wanted to produce a magnetic field in the galaxy, you'd actually need to be able to produce a high voltage. Use some kind of high voltage to actually be able to drive the currents to form a magnetic field in the first place. And that's going to be very difficult. So what you usually have to do, this is kind of standard paradigm of fields, is you take some kind of seed field which existed prior to the formation of the galaxy itself. And so this may come from some basically astrophysical process prior to the galaxy forming, or it may come from some kind of early universe mechanism. And you need to amplify that. So the amplification is still a reasonably tricky problem, but it's easier than the seed field problem. So when a galaxy forms, it compresses because the gases of some reasonable ionization, it drags in the magnetic field with it, and this enhances the field strength. So for free, when the galaxy forms, you get amplification in the field strength from that existed before of around 1,000 to 10,000 times. So if you take the magnetic fields you expected that you've observed today of around a microgauss, that means that if this is the only amplification you've got, you can start with something of around 10 to the minus 10 Gauss, and that would be able to produce what you see today. What is another way of amplifying these magnetic fields, and is probably needed in order to maintain them in galaxies, is some kind of dynamo. So the details of all these processes are quite complicated. Basically, if you have an effective dynamo, it basically gives you an exponential amplification of fields. So every time you wind round in a spiral galaxy, say, you amplify by some constant factor. Keep going. So if you do the calculations of how many windings you get, the galaxy form and stuff, you can calculate you have an enhancement. You can possibly have an enhancement up to some like dramatic amount, so almost 10 to 14 times. And this means that your minimum seed field that you would need combined with the adiabatic amplification is tiny. So it's found 10 to the minus 23 Gauss. But there are problems with this as well. So one is that these dynamo mechanisms aren't certain. At some point you expect the field strength to be strong enough that you have some kind of back reaction which basically kills the dynamo.
The other thing is, going back to these observations of high-redshift galaxies that I mentioned earlier were important. If you imagine, you know, as you go forward in time, your magnetic fields are exponentially amplified. If you look back in time, you expect them to be exponentially suppressed. So if you're going back to around redshift 1, that's quite a considerable time, so you'd expect the field to be a lot weaker back then. But if you see something, as these observations are, which are of comparable strength, then that suggests that your dynamo effect has to be able to happen in a much shorter time. And this reduces the essentially the amount of enhancement that you think you can get from a dynamo. Sorry.
How long would be quite long? Millions of years?
It's all of the order of hundreds of millions, I think. Don't quote me on
So the age is a significant time of the age of the universe.
Yes, yeah. Oh yeah, it's a significant, to get to this level you're basically assuming most of the age of the universe. So this had, there were implications for this when pre there being any dark energy days, like circa 96. This was somewhat of a problem because the universe wasn't nearly developed. And sorry, the third problem I was just going to mention is basically in elliptical galaxies you don't have any real coherent rotation. So you need some kind of different dynamo mechanism. Certainly you can't really be the same as you would expect in a spiral galaxy. So the question is, what could generate your seed fields? If you're thinking you might want an astrophysical explanation of your seed fields, what you might look at is an AGM or something like that. So this is a M87, this is an active synchrotron again, and the galaxy is like in there, and these are all the radio lobes produced in the cluster. So these are all, because these are being a synchrotron, this is all like energetic magnetized plasma. And so you can obviously see this is spewing out masses of magnetic fields. So you can imagine a mechanism where your AGN is just chucking out fields, like chucking out magnetic field. You use some way of stirring this out into the surrounding medium, but this could provide a regional seed field. Something else that you might think of as known producing magnetic fields, astrophysically a supernova, so it's the Crab Nebula. If you basically take the number of supernovae you'd expect in a galaxy and say they were all like of the Crab Nebula remnant sort of magnetic field strength, then you would have something which could basically produce straight off the magnetic field strength you observe in the galaxy. The problem is you expect these are small, so you expect them to be correlated on much smaller scales than you see. So in that spiral galaxy, the correlations were of sort of size of the spiral arms. So you would need something in there to suppress the small scale structure and to enhance the large scale correlation of this. So this may work, it may not. So I'm just going to skip on from any more astrophysical seeds and just talk about early universe type mechanisms. So the two sort of thing classes you can envisage are things that happen after inflation. So these would be some kind of phase transition. The problem with these, so you, maybe at electro weak, an obvious thing, you can look at some way of producing magnetic fields then. The big problem you have with this kind of mechanism is you have a horizon problem. So the horizon at these phase transitions is tiny, but your correlations are on galactic scales. So how do you basically take a field correlated on these tiny scales and make it correlated on much larger scales? Well, one way to do it is to start with an extremely strong field, and then you have a kind of, that basically gives you a correlation on much larger scales, which would be very weak. But then you have these very strong small-scale fields. Another thing you can do, if you can produce helical fields, then you can rely on an inverse cascade which transfers your power up to larger scales. But these mechanisms have some kind of difficulty. The natural thing you might think of, you want to generate large-scale fields, would be in to do inflation and inflation. So, and you can get nearly scale invariant field sumness, which allows you to have coherent fields of similar strength in galaxies and clusters and superclusters. And it has, it's nice because for cosmologists, because you can see this in the CMB and everything like that. The big problem with it is that because electromagnetism with no charges is conformally invariant, then inflation basically produces exceptionally tiny fields naturally. So you need to make some kind of modification to electromagnetic sector to basically see anything at all. So there's been various kind of classes proposed. The sort of classic thing is this Turner and Withrow, because then they looked at classes where you take the electromagnetic Lagrangian and you multiply it by something which is time varying during inflation, so a factor which depends on the inflaton or depends on the curvature or something. But recently, in this paper by Demopsi and Mukhanov, which basically looks at this again and suggests that actually if you go down those routes, you end up producing enough magnetic fields that they contribute significantly to the energy density, and then you have a back reaction effect, which means these are kind of ruled out. So whilst Turner and Widrow suggested you could produce up to like 10 to the minus 10 Gauss levels, these kind of recent calculations actually revise this down to say basically the maximum you could produce would be around 10 to the minus 30. So it looks like inflation is a bad place to produce primary magnetic fields. It looks like causal mechanisms are pretty tricky, and astrophysical mechanisms are pretty tricky. This is a fairly wide-open problem.
The argument is that at back inflation times, that would have corresponded to so much magnetic field that it would have stopped inflation. Is that what you mean? Or
yes, I think so. I follow their argument certainly loosely. I can point at that paper for more details. That's essentially their argument. If you don't want to affect background solution, then your magnetic field cannot be larger than this, in those kind of values, at 1 megaparsec scale. So that's the crucial thing. These field strengths are all what you'd expect smooth on a 1 megaparsec scale. So the key thing is usually you overproduce on very small scales. So given all these problems, why would you want to look for primordial magnetic fields? You can kind of turn this argument on its head and attempt to justify this work. So what you look at is because any kind of standard mechanism of inflation produces very tiny fields, you can use this as a kind of way of validating quantum inflation. So if you saw any primordial magnetic fields, this would indicate some kind of alternative mechanism. But finding a signal of them would be very interesting. But in the absence of that, continually pushing down an upper limit has some kind of use as a tool for just checking the standard cosmological model. So I'm just going to talk about the work we've been doing. So just we're talking about how you set this work up. So throughout almost its entire life, the universe is a good conductor. And this is true basically at scales like even post-recombination, when the ionization fraction of barons is very low, this is still valid at scales bigger than that. What is slightly trickier to think is that because post-recombination you have a small fraction of ionized baryons, but a very much larger amount of non-ionized baryons, is it valid to treat that as one, as a single conducting fluid? And if you think about it, the answer is yes, provided you're on scales larger than I guess it's about the wave number is 70 inverse megaparsecs, so you're looking at something around 0.1 megaparsecs, provided you're larger than the scale that's fine. So going back to what I was talking about, magnetic fields during the universe, they redshift to smaller field values, so with the scale factor squared. So what we're going to do in this is just define a co-moving magnetic field which just gets rid of this, the redshifting. So that's this. And if you work out how that contributes to the energy momentum tensor, you get these, looks like a standard thing, but with factors of A to the fourth out of front. So with this, I'm just going to define perturbations to the magnetic energy density and anisotropic stress, and just like this. So pulling out this delta B for the perturbation to the energy density and the perturbation to the anisotropic stress, it's normalizing by the photon energy density pressure. The crucial thing to note is these perturbations are basically constant in time at linear order. It's a little tricky exactly how you set this up. So we're treating these perturbations as first order, even though they're second order in magnetic fields. And one thing this means is that because this delta B is proportional to B squared, and we're going to treat B as being itself as being Gaussian, then the perturbations are actually non-Gaussian. Also, this has a non-zero expectation value on the background, which can cause you trouble, but we're going to neglect that as well. So, if you look at the very early universe when these magnetic fields were formed, you can get some quite interesting behaviour. So, generally, I'm going to be thinking about inflation produced magnetic fields in this. But if you imagine the magnetic fields appear at some time, control time tau b, which is prior to neutrino decoupling, then you have the interesting effect of basically because the photons, neutrinos, and baryons are all scattering off each other, they can't have any anisotropic stress in themselves. So prior to neutrino decoupling, there is a non-zero anisotropic stress provided by the magnetic fields. And this on its own sources growth and curvature perturbation. So you have the co-moving curvature has a logarithmic growth, which is proportional to the magnitude of the magnetic anisotropic stress and grows logarithmically depending on production time. After the neutrinos decouple, they quickly grow an anisotropic stress which counteracts the magnetic anisotropic stress. And the total anisotropic stress quickly goes to zero, and this stops growing. So after that time, you have three types of perturbations generated. One is something called the passive perturbation, and these are from these curvature modes, which are sourced prior to neutrino decoupling. And it has an amplitude proportional to pi b and proportional to this log factor, which is the ratio of neutrino decoupling to the magnetic field production. Then there's two other types you get. There's compensated stress modes, which looks like a kind of isocurvature mode. So there's no curvature, but you have the magnetic anisotropic stress, and it's compensated by anisotropic stress in the neutrinos. And then you have a compensated density mode, which has a non-zero magnetic energy density, and it's compensated by perturbations to all the other species. And this is similar for tensor and vector modes. So the tensors have an equivalent of this mode and that mode, and the vectors only have the equivalent of this mode because they don't have any. They don't have all the potential modes of basically decay. So the other ingredient you need to put in this, the statistics of the magnetic field, and I'm going to be ignoring any holistic magnetic field in this work. And you assume your magnetic field has a Gaussian power spectrum like this. And the power spectrum itself I'm going to assume is a power law, which kind of standard way. And rather than using amplitude like that, we're going to talk about the variance on 1 megaparsec scale, so if you smooth out the field on 1 megaparsec scale. The statistics of this determine the amplitudes of all the modes, the scalar, vector, and tensor modes, the passive modes, the compensated modes. So they're all fixed by knowing phi lambda, the spectral index, and the time of production. The other slight complication, which is quite a, it's a big complication, but I'm just going to throw it away in one bullet point, is that you have various important nonlinear effects which are very which you can't treat in a linear perturbation code like CAM or which we've been using. So we have various approximations to what's essentially diffusion damping by propagating alpha modes on small scales, and there's also a magnetic gene effect. So you have a background magnetic pressure, and when objects collapse, they drag this in, and the pressure enhancement basically stops the collapse. So it's like the standard gene effect. Okay, so enough of this. What basically do you see if you put all this in? So if you look at the CMB, this is the temperature per spectrum of the CMB at a field strength of basically 5 nanogauss. And so that's just the primary mode only. If you throw in some of the first set of magnetic modes, these are the compensated ones. So this comes from the scalars, this comes from the vectors, and this comes from the tensors. You can see that basically the only one of these that's going to be important is this vector compensated mode because it's high on small scales. So that will become important. If you throw in these passive modes, which are the ones sourced prior to neutrino decoupling, where you have these bands. So the width of the band corresponds to, if you are at the top, that means your magnetic field is produced at weak heating, effectively, and if you're at the bottom, it's produced at, say, the electroweak phase transition. I can't what weak heating temperature is. So these come from the tensor modes, and these come from the scalar modes. So you can see that basically the tensor modes might be important depending on the time of production and the amplitude. So they might be bigger on these large scales. So otherwise, it's basically feasible to throw everything else away apart from this vector compensated modes and these tensor passive modes. If you look at the other power spectra, the effects are the same. So this is E-mode polarization. This green one is large on small scales, and the yellow one is large on large scales. If you look at the B modes, then again, this yellow actually dominates on the larger scales. This thing corresponds to a tensor scalar ratio of 0.1, and the vector compensated, again, is large on small scales. And this purple line is just the lens contribution you look at. So most of the effects you see have in the CMB basically come from the initial conditions that you're forced to set up by having the magnetic field there in the first place. If you look at matter power spectrum, so this is the primary matter power spectrum, and this is what you get from the scalar magnetic field. So this is actually driven largely by the evolution. So it's from the Lorentz force of the magnetic field acting on the baryons themselves. And you get this bump. So the peak of this bump corresponds to the scales where nonlinear effects start becoming important. So when you have the genes effect and when you have this diffusion damping, which killed it off. But you can see that there's a large excess of small-scale power. Just to figure, the passive modes are, again, unimportant for the magnetic power spectrum. Okay, so what this excess of small-scale power does is it means you overproduce halos of around this size. So this is about the mass of a large galaxy, the peak. So you're overproducing these small halos, basically. And if you think where this might be important, one place it might be important is in the Sunyer-Zeldovich effect on the CMB. So you can go through and calculate that. And so this shows a slightly complicated plot. This is the primary CMB contribution, including ASZ. This dotted green line is what you'd normally expect from the ASZ effect. If you start throwing in magnetic fields of increasing strength, you go upwards like this. So you can see that basically
this red, these two red lines are basically ruled out. So that rules out fields at around 5 nanogauss and around 4 nanogauss. And sorry, this, so this, these black points are from SPT. So it's, this was a while ago, so these are probably old data. But you're probably consistent with something around 3 nanogauss or around 2 nanogauss. So with all these in mind, you can do the constraints properly. So
I didn't expect much SC from 10 to 12 solar mass.
Well, that's what feels you're right, you don't expect much. It's dominated by things around this kind of level. I'm not sure what, on reflection, I'm not actually sure what field strength they're plotted here. So when you increase the field strength, the magnetic field, it shifts up and that way. So you can have a...
Yeah, peak shifts.
Peak shifts. The peak shifts, basically. And because it's all these amplitudes, so these amplitudes are because the SL effect is a very strong function of the amplitude of the matter power spectrum, and the amplitude of the matter power spectrum itself depends on the fourth power of the magnetic field strength, then as soon as you start increasing it, this rockets upwards. So any constraint you think will come from the small scale CMB, the large scale CMB from these two different modes, or the small-scale matter power spectrum. So I talked about Sonia's Elderbit effect. The other thing we're going to look at is Lyman alpha. To do these constraints in a kind of standard cosmological way, you basically take a full six-dimensional cosmological parameter space, you augment it with three more parameters. So one of them is the amplitude of the magnetic fields, one of them is the spectral index, and the other one is just basically it's the production time, so I'm just going to write it in this form on the logarithm. I'm going to throw several data sets at it, some standard CMB data sets, WMAT, ACPAR, and QUAD, Lyman alpha data from SDSS quasars, and SZ data from SVT. People have done these before, but the constraints have largely been CMB only. These ones with SDSS, it was just SDSS galaxy data to improve your general constraints. So the first constraint, these are CMB only, so the primary CMB. And you can see that if you put this together, this is the this two-dimensional plot is there's the amplitude versus the spectral index. So it turns out that the production time is basically relevant. So I'm going to exclude them. You can see this is the marginalized amplitude, which is probably the most interesting plot to focus on. So you can see that basically CMB only gets you to like a 2 sigma confidence limit of about 6 nanogauss. If you throw in Sonia Zolbish data through SPT, then this shift this in somewhat. So it starts to exclude very blue magnetic spectral indices, and it also shifts the sort of land value you might have to more around 4 nanogauss.
What template are you using for the SA?
I'm basically coming out of cell draft prescription with a Jenkins mass function and some recent stuff. So in the SBT paper, which did SL analysis, and we did that. I used basically the same prescription they did for them when they were talking about Maxim Seljak type of this. So you may expect some scaling because Maxim Seljak is not quite right. See you nodding smugly over there.
Yeah, no, I didn't say that.
But actually, that shouldn't affect your. Because the magnetic field is such a strong, so the amplitude of your spectrum is such a strong function of the magnetic field strength that actually doesn't affect it too much. even if you multiply up and down by a factor of 2.
Just that recent templates are a lot lower than what TS has predicted.
Yes, that is true. I use some other tweaks as well, but I don't think I put in an overall multiplier. So these are, these constraints are getting down a bit. The most constraining combinations, if you throw in line now for data, so if you put in line now for data, it's basically constraining you at around here. So at the kind of, at this kind of scale where this starts to be quite important. And you can only do, the treatment is only proximate because you, to do this properly, you have to run massive simulations depending on the exact power spectrum shape. But you can see that basically this gets you down to a much lower value. So around 1 nanogauss is about the allowed value for magnetic fields. I will...
So do you, when you do CMB plus SC, do you fit for the point sources as well?
Yes, I think so. These are the point source amplitudes that we talked about in the SPT paper, and I think I basically add that in every time.
This is 150 gigahertz data? Should be. Right?
Yes, it was. So all these are normal.
Dustin's definition. What's the SMG subtractor?
Yeah, but I think they subtracted the Dusty Star formula, but they have a residual point
in 220. And there's residual.
Yes. There. Yeah. So that's the estimate. Their estimate of the residuals, I think.
Do you rely on much on keeping that fixed?
No, as I was saying, basically this, because these are essentially because these amplitudes are such a strong function, actually. Adding in small tweaks doesn't make that much difference to the overall constraints of the magnetic field strength itself. So you can get away with being a bit rubbish with your analysis, fortunately. But but because the line alpha is a much more constrained combination anyway, when you take the final constraints, yeah, so it turns out it doesn't matter that much. So the remaining thing to talk about. I guess I have a basically minute to talk about this. Caprini and Dura, a long time ago, tried to look at what this effect might have on nuclear synthesis. So if you have a power law magnetic field spectrum and it goes all the way to extremely scales, so this is a big failure in this analysis, you're extrapolating many, many orders of magnitude, then you would expect you'd have a lot of energy in the magnetic field then, and eventually that's turned into gravitational waves, and then you can use the nuclear synthesis constraints on the extra amount of energy density you're allowing gravitational waves. And they, for instance, if you look at the causal process, then it puts extremely strong limits on the magnetic field strength you can have. But nearly scalar invariant fields, which we're looking at, are largely constrained. So if you put the contours, if you work out what this does to our contours, it basically eliminates, for inflation reproduced stuff, it eliminates anything on the right of this orange line. For electrically reproduced things, it eliminates anything on the right of this. So this basically tightens this up a little, but it doesn't do much. And it's a little dodgy, I think, because it assumes such a large validity of your power law. So that brings me almost to the end. So in conclusion, the origin of cosmic magnetic fields is still an unsolved problem. Whether it's an early universe mechanism, maybe they're complicated to get anything to fit. CMB on its own provides weak constraints on the magnetic fields, but if you start throwing any small scale matter power data, this gets better. So this has implications for how good it is in the future. So if so you take your existing data and you tighten up your error bars on it, this actually doesn't gain you much because you're searching for essentially an upper limit. If you tighten up by a factor of 10, then your amplitude on your magnetic power spectrum, because it goes with the fourth power of the magnetic field, basically, you tighten up your limits on b lambda by 10 to the 4th root. So the only way to get increasingly good constraints is really to push to smaller scales. So you need constraints at small scales to be able to give it. There's a kind of nice trade-off with the shape of the power spectrum, which means that it's essentially a linear increase. So you, with the smaller scale you approach, with the upper limit of the magnetic field. And that's it. So.
Do you use polarization data for what you have right now?
Yes. The CMB.
What?
Yeah, the CMB analysis uses polarization. From WMAC and Quad. Apple would make a nice addition.
So this large scale excess, sorry, small scale power that you're seeing in the matter, how much is it confused with the nonlinear structure formation?
Good question for it. It's difficult to say.
So you've used probably the Smith et al. Prescription for the nonlinear.
Small scale constraints we use are from the matter powers, from the SDSS. The Lyman alpha quasar data, and that's calibrated. That was done using simulations with. So this is where the dodginess of it, that particularly comes in. So they use simulations with a effective spectrum index and running at some point. And obviously this won't fit that because it's got a great big lump there. But you would actually, if this was there, you'd expect it to have more effect. So this is some kind of limit. And from discussions with a few of my faculty that actually generally just constraints at these kind of scales are us. Reasonably insensitive to smaller scales, so hopefully you should get away with that.
Any more questions? Let's thank the chief one more time.